stretch out, but your skin can bring you so much pain. Now I hear you say, you got the best of both ways. Won't you come and take a walk in my shoes and tell me if you take my place? Under the cover of my skin, I'll burn all your names. If it's all the same, I'll keep on walking. Under the cover of my skin.
You gotta do it. Welcome to episode number 114, the Inside Running Podcast. Thanks for joining us for another week. This week's episode is sponsored by our friends at Styx Brewery out of Newcastle. They're sponsoring the show this week because they're in the running for the hottest 100 craft beers and they need our help to vote for the Inside Running Pale Ale. So if your listeners out there, you can go to our website. It's Gab's Hottest 100 Craft Beers. We'll put a link in the show notes before January 17th. Give us a few votes for the beers. That'd be really appreciated. Welcome to my co-host. Up in Canberra, been in Bateman's Bay, been a very dramatic week for Bradley since last time we spoke. Welcome to the show, Bradley Croker.
Thanks, Brady. Yeah, I've been a bit off the grid the last week. And, yeah, there's no risk of fires here at the moment, but the breathing's not so great.
Good to hear your voice, because last time we heard your voice, you got off air, you were going to go eat a meat pie on New Year's Eve, and then you were going to go watch some sandcastle sculpting.
Correct. Neither happened.
Well, welcome to Moose as well. How are you going?
I'm still here, mate. Just kicking along.
You got any dramatic stories from down your way to share tonight?
Anything dramatic happened in my life? Nothing dramatic here. Nothing a lot right. Going on, though. It's been a bit scarier.
Has a bit, hasn't it? Not so much in the running world, but down here in Australia, it's hitting news all over the place, these fires. Maybe, Bradley, you kick us off and tell us how your week panned out, how you were affected.
So from a running point of view, I ran 38.5K. So on the Monday, I just did 45 minutes in the morning. Actually, Viv came out on the bike, so we just did laps around Surfside, and then we recorded that night, and as I said to you, that we're going to go and have meat pies for lunch and go down and watch a sand sculpting competition. And also said I was going to go and get off the road and run down at Runnyford Road, where I ran with McGowan and Matt Johnson about a month earlier for our long run. And I said to Viv, I'll get up in the morning and go down there and do that. So then Tuesday morning, which is New Year's Eve, woke up. And Viv showed me a video. She goes, I don't think you'll be running at Runnyford Road. It was on fire. And it was just super hot outside. And, yeah, you looked out and it was just anywhere to the south was just black. So we knew that it was going to be a pretty intense day. So I actually headed over to Bateman's Bay just to grab some supplies, like some milk and bread in case things went pear-shaped and we lost power and supermarkets closed down, and also got some petrol. And it was a ghost town. Like, I put some photos up on Facebook, and Bateman's Bay on New Year's Eve, like, you would never be able to get a park. They have a section for overflow because it's just a tourist mecca. But I could park in the main street. It was a ghost town. So I did that, and then we headed back, and we're on the north side of the bay, and it was like 38, 39 degrees. Super windy, and so we were just swimming sort of every 20-30 minutes and just watching the water bombers bombing the south, or pretty much everywhere south down the coast. We heard explosions, which got into the back of the industrial estate at Bateman's Bay, so businesses were going up there and you just hear these loud booms, and you just felt so useless. Like, I think it was at that point where I went, you know what, I'm going to volunteer with the Rural Fire Service, because you just, like, you know, you're relatively fit and healthy, and you just go, well, what am I doing here just sitting on the beach while, you know, houses are being burnt? So then about midday, we didn't feel like we were under threat at that point. Midday, it went eerie. Like, it was like a scene out of like Dante's Peak or something. Day turned to night. It was like this real reddy orange sort of feel. And then we lost power for 2 days. So that was a bit surreal. And supermarkets were down. They did open and they were just taking cash only, but there was like 3-hour lines to get in. And even when the power came back on, they were still only taking cash, and the supermarkets were out of everything. Like you couldn't get milk, couldn't even get long life milk. Baby formula was getting pretty low, not much bread. So yeah, so I didn't run New Year's Eve or New Year's Day. And then the biggest issue was they knew it was going to be bad again on the Saturday, and they wanted to get like all the tourists out of town. But the problem was the road north was being on and off, open then closed. So it was a bit unpredictable. South, you couldn't go the main road. You had to pretty much go into every small town along the way. So it would have been like probably a 9-hour trip. So we decided to stay down just because the air quality was better in Batemans Bay, and I just couldn't stand being stuck in traffic, especially when potentially the road gets blocked and you have to turn around anyway, which happened to a few people that were down near us. So we stayed on the till the Saturday, yeah, and then that's when it probably got worse for us. Around lunchtime, a fire got in the back of our suburb, and the fireys came down and said to expect some sort of ember attacks. So at that point, Viv and Lily and Viv's mum headed to the beach, which is only a couple hundred metres away. And Viv's dad and I sort of just were hosing down the house, just getting ready. But luckily the water bombers, like they're amazing. These the helicopters with the hoses or the buckets, they come in and they pretty much just stopped that threat for us. So, but then we lost power for another couple of days, and then we came back on last night, and when we came back there's still no power there. So it was even driving home last night, because we had to drive south through all the towns that were pretty much destroyed. Like Cobargo is on the highway, and the main street, like big buildings are just are a mess. And even driving home, visibility was like 100 meters a lot of the way home, because it's just so thick, the smoke. So that was my week. In terms of running, did that run on the Monday, got out on the 2nd of Jan, did an hour at 4:03, sort of ran through Batemans Bay.
How smoky was that?
No, actually, that was a surprising thing, was the air down there was way better than... Like, you'd think it doesn't make sense that you're that close to the fires, but obviously because of the... the sea breeze or the direction of the wind, it wasn't that bad. And that's why we decided to stay, because we thought, well, Canberra's been so bad that it's not great for Lily to be sort of breathing this in, and we felt relatively safe, so we thought we'd stay. So I did that on the 2nd. Then on the 3rd, just 55 minutes at 4:12s. Didn't run Saturday, and then, we made the decision to drive back late last night. So that was my week.
Did you get some strange looks when you were out jogging? Like, sure, you're the only person exercising in the whole of Batemans Bay?
No, I wouldn't say I got funny looks, because the air quality was pretty good down there. I don't think anybody thought too much of it. I did get on one of the runs, because there's so much media down there, because we're on the north side of the bay, the only way to get across to the south is via the bridge. And I was coming back across the bridge at about maybe 5:05. And so the 5 o'clock news was on, and they took up the whole path. Like, there was a guy there, there was the cameraman and the presenter, and then there was this other guy about 5 metres away stopping traffic. So I was on my run, and he's like, come back in 2 minutes or something. So I went back and did a loop and then came back. So there's a fair bit of media down there. But no, I didn't get that many looks. It was a pretty surreal experience. A few positives come out. Like, sorry, go, Moose.
Oh, at any time were you advised to leave? When were you advised to leave? And by who? And how were you advised?
So we were advised... Well, after the New Year's attack, those couple of days, once we got power back, we didn't have any TV, so there was no TV reception after the first fire. So all we had was the radio, and they were pretty much saying that, like, any tourist, just leave. We don't want you here. And I guess technically we are tourists, but Viv's parents spend a lot of time down there. And as I said, like, the air was better. Where we were was a low risk area, And we spoke to a guy who was a couple of doors up. He's part of the Fieries, and he said, look, it's a pretty small risk, but he still got rid of his kids all headed down to Shepparton. So he got them out of there. But we felt relatively safe. But then on the Saturday fire, the Fieries came down and said, it's burning pretty hard a couple of kilometres away, so, expect some ember attacks. And it was on the radio to evacuate as well.
Most scared you've ever been in your life, Bradley?
Probably not. I felt where it started to get real was when they said ember attacks are on their way, and that's when Viv and Lily went to the beach, and I'm like, all right, this is sort of getting real now. Like, put on sort of a long sleeve shirt and some shoes rather than thongs, and started just hosing the deck down, trying to get as high, because it's a two-story house, so just trying to get as high as we can to get up and hose down the roof. And but then, as I said, the bombers they were amazing. Like, in that small area, because Batemans Bay wasn't a major fire, they still had like two or three helicopters. So you'd imagine like all down the coast, like, because this thing's grown, like it's a bloody tumor. Like, it's been going for 5 weeks, but there's certainly worse areas than Batemans Bay. So if they're putting the same resources into those areas, they've done a pretty good job. Yeah. But I feel sorry for the, like, obviously people lose their lives, their houses, the animals die, but I also feel sorry for a lot of businesses down there, because my parents owned a bakery in Ulladulla for 30 odd years, and like, this time of the year is make or break for a lot of those businesses, because winter's, it's a ghost town down there, so they really rely on this tourism period. And I remember when Mum and Dad had the business, they would hate it if they got some really bad weather. People in the caravan parks would just go, oh, let's go home early. And so this is obviously more extreme than that, but there's going to be a lot of businesses that, will struggle after this. And even there's a town called Braidwood, which, if you're going from Canberra to Batemans Bay, everybody drives through it. No one's been able to get through there for the last 5 weeks. So that place is pretty much shut down. So, I feel sorry for those people with businesses down there.
Well put. Mm. Back in the Canberra smoke now, though.
Yeah, got back last night. And
Worst city in the world.
Visibility, yeah, it was so bad. And even today, like, I haven't really been out much, but it's impossible to keep the smoke out because it gets into the garage and just breathing it in all day, you sort of end up with that sort of bit of a headache. And so I haven't run today, and I'm not sure when I'm going to run. I just don't see much point in it. Like, going out for an hour, does the harm outweigh the good? Yeah, so.
Probably does if you go outside. Mm. But if you can find somewhere where there's sort of shut there. Like you said, your gym opens the door, right?
So we drove past today when we were down at the supermarket, drove past the gym and the front door was open. So I'm like, well, it's probably not much different to run outside.
That is dumb.
Can't make that up.
Yeah.
Trying to find a new gym, I reckon. Well, it's good you're all in one piece. We had a lot of listeners write in asking how you were going and making sure you were all right. And it was because we pretty much didn't hear from you for like 48 hours, I think. We recorded Monday, we were talking Tuesday morning, and then it wasn't until Thursday morning that I woke up to a message from you Thursday morning.
Yeah, and then went off again Saturday, and then actually powered down there because Viv's parents stayed. Power only came on today from Saturday lunch, from Saturday afternoon. So they've been out without power for a while.
Mm. Righty-o, Moose, give us some stats. You had a big running week. Tell us all about it.
I did have a big running week. I went to the gym on Monday morning and ran. I think I ran there. Maybe I ran. I don't know. I ran it before the gym. Then in the afternoon. Oh, no, sorry. I ran in the morning. Ran with Watto from his house. He's got a pool. Jumped in the pool afterwards. It was quite refreshing. We just cruised because I was pretty rooted after Sunday. So, 20, I ran even on a flat run, it was like 206 meters still of climbing. It's really hard to find flat spots around here, even when you're trying your hardest not to. 15k, and then in the arvo, got out, because this was the Monday. Still everyone was still away. Ballarat turns to a ghost town over this period between Christmas and New Year. It's real empty. Everyone goes to the coast or up to the river. They also go to like the mountain areas, so it was real empty and felt a bit strange running. Went to the gym in the other. Then Tuesday, I did do a workout. Let me just check what it was. I think I did 6x K. Yep. So I ran around the lake. Young fella's just come back from Melbourne where he was at boarding school. Nick Fidley, he's a good runner. He's going to be a gun. I think he's trying to make, his goal is to make World Cross. So brought him down to the group for the first time. Got 3K into the warm up. And I asked him, oh, how long do you normally warm up for, Nick? And he said, 2K. Classic. He also does really fast reps with lots of rest. And, he did 4 of the Ks. I did 6 of them. It was about, I think, about 257s to 303s maybe. Oh, no, the last one was in a dead headwind, 307s. But 90 seconds recovery. So felt like I was just starting to get back with this run. And then jogged in the arvo. Jog from work, I believe. Then Wednesday, I was in Melbourne. So that was, that was New Year's Eve. So yeah, went to Melbourne and got out on the piss, you know how it goes. And then woke up in the morning, bit rusty, ran around Princes Park with Cole and Matt, who we were up there with for dinner. A few people out, not that many, you know, New Year's Day morning, it's pretty empty, which was disappointing. And then in the afternoon, jumped back to Ballarat, did my good loop, 8.5K. Thursday, went out on the Moose Loop, which is a loop I got here, about 17Ks, and I decided to add some surges in, so 12 by 30-second hard, 90-second easy, and then I added 12 by 15 hard, 45 seconds easy. So the idea was to turn the legs over, change gears, that kind of thing. I felt all right. Afternoon, ran with my mate Matty Freeman. Friday, I took out Rad, you know, our mate Rad, the strength guy.
Yeah,
He's been up. Yep, took him out, classic footy player. Took him out for about an hour run, ran 30 minutes out. He was chuffing along, just killing it, big strides, loping. And I thought, geez, he's going pretty quick. And then at about the 5K mark, just started to hear some real noise coming from his way. Lots of huffing and puffing and this kind of stuff. So we had to take a bit of a breather. And then he absolutely died on the way back. And it was about, I was babysitting him on the way home, holding his hand as we got back to the gym. Classic footy player mentality. Just flog yourself the first few K and hold on. That afternoon, actually, I went to, that Boston Marathon thing I was telling you about. Went down to have a look at some of the shooting locations they had mapped out in Geelong. And so I ran after that. It's pretty smoky. So down there, I was sitting out there for lunch. And it was beautiful day, clear sky. And then within like 10 minutes, it turned into a haze. That's how quick the smoke came in. And then it kind of dissipated and I ran. And I ran around the river there. Nice place to run, the Barwon River. Saturday morning, 2x12 minutes at thresh heart rate. So just chuck the heart rate on. Try to aim to keep it between like 168, 175. So did that. Average 312 and then 316. 2.5 minutes between in the afternoon. And with some big boys. Can't remember who it was, but they're obviously some of the bigger crowd I run with, based on my title and my Strava. And then Sunday morning, third wheel with Mona and Berkey. So Mona and Berkey have a bit of a love affair going on, and I just felt a little uncomfortable with those boys. But freezing cold, feels like 2 degrees. Can you believe that? Is that not the most insane thing? Smoky from bushfires felt like 2 degrees. I had to wear a jacket. I would have worn gloves if I knew it was going to be that cold. I had numb fingers. Just unbelievably cold. Ran 30K though, first 30K for ages. Battled late. If 536 meters, so a bit hilly, but battled late for sure. And I was saying to the boys, I reckon the first 2 to 3 long runs back, that they hurt, and then you start getting comfortable over the long runs. But there's a bit of an adaption period.
Did Mono run 30, or was he on the bike?
Oh, no, he's on the bike, yeah. He's on the bike, yeah.
Does he hand you drinks and stuff, or just there for entertainment?
He gave me a drink of his drink bottle that was there, and he gave me it, and I had a sip, and he's like, I thought, what the fuck is this? It tastes disgusting. Oh, I don't like water, so I put lemon juice in my water.
Lemon juice?
Just the most sour, disgusting taste you'll ever think.
It's zesty for you.
Maybe that's the secret, Moose. Get on the lemon water.
But yeah, he comes out, talks a bunch of rubbish, and makes the run go quicker. It's good he gets out there, keeps part of the scene.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's really cool, actually. And then he came on the bike for a little bit in the afternoon. I ran with, I had a mate Pistol down, and then we ran with a few boys. And there, a lap of the lake, a little bit extra. Yeah, it's good. Good week, 176K. And, yeah, just another piece of the puzzle.
Mm. 176Ks. Brad, I reckon he's building for a marathon shortly.
He's getting there. He's got the fire back.
Heard some whispers about which one.
I want you to come to Country Champs, actually. I want you to come to Country Champs.
Vic Country Champs.
Yeah, I'm invited in your program now.
Yeah. And you'll smash you the week of.
He's starting to go all right again, isn't he, Bradley?
Yeah, he's getting there. As he said, he's 30K, I reckon another 2 weeks.
When's Vic Country Champs?
2 weeks.
I think you'd have him at the moment, Brady.
What are you going to do, Moose, the 10K there?
Nah, 5K.
5K? Jeez. Shooting for a 14.08.
You know, it's a good indication how well you're going with how much banter you got going in the group. That's a good indication.
You mean you personally?
Oh, the group in general, whoever's there. If they're starting to chirp up a bit, getting a bit lippy, then that's a good sign that they're quietly confident, I reckon.
Yeah.
If they're hanging at the back, just holding on, keeping real quiet, just avoiding any banter, That's a sign they're battling.
Hat pulled probably down, like over their eyes kind of thing, just keeping a low profile.
Yeah.
Stopping to drop the shoelace.
Yeah. Sorry, boys, need a piss.
4 toilet breaks in a long run.
Oh, good.
Yeah. I'll tell you about my week. I thought I was going to be up at Falls Creek the whole time, but I only lasted up there for 4 days in total. Not sure how much altitude benefit I got from 4 days up there, but all good. Did my 14K by myself on the Monday, just because that group goes at 9:30 and I was up at like 5 with the baby and probably a bit too long to wait around. So I went solo for 14K, averaged 4:22s. Felt pretty poppy actually for a Monday morning, felt good. Did the group run the afternoon at 5:30 and did some strides after that. So that was kind of 9K all up after the strides. Had a bit of a good group there. Daniel Wallace, The Beast, Nick Earle. All these names are popping up on Strava here, James Coleman. On Tuesday morning up there, I met up with Jared Clifford, Tim Logan, Jordan Tyler, and this younger fella that I have, Callum Davies. You guys remember he won the Zatopek 1500-meter race? Has the hat
Queenslander.
On.
Queenslander?
Yeah.
The hat. The fella with the hat.
Nearly won Albie Thomas Mile as well. If you watch that video, he kind of got checked right at the end there. He kind of got cut off a bit. He should have probably won that if you look at the footage. Yeah, so he's gone to World Juniors. So I don't know much about junior kids, but now I know a lot about him now because he absolutely put me to the sword in this workout. He did 6x1K. I did 8x1K. We did them on the aqueduct there. Instructions were to hit like 255s, Moose, but we kind of were going probably a bit slower than that. Like it was just probably digging a bit too deep to be hitting 255s. Let me open up these K splits here. We just went from like some random pole to another random pole, so I'm not exactly sure how accurate they were, but they come up pretty close on Strava. 259, tailwind one way, 306, headwind the other way, 258, 303, 302, 305. Not sure if I read out 8 then. Might have skipped a couple. Anyway, you can check my Strava if you want to 100% know that. But, yeah, Callum Davies, he's a smooth operator, boys. He just looks like he's jogging. He had the hat on again, the signature hat. He's just wearing, like, Zoom Flyers, like a heavier kind of training shoe. Punched, I think, his last one in, like, 2:49. Made us all look like we were power walking out the back there. Watch this space for that guy. It was good to...
Who coaches him?
I'm not 100% sure. Oh, actually, I did ask him that, Bradley. Yeah, an older gentleman, he said, has been coaching him for a long time up at Queensland. I didn't recognise his name. But, yeah, been with the same coach for a long time. And I think he does a bit of his own, like, self-coaching on his days off. Like, this guy just maybe writes his workouts for him and then he listens to his body on the other nights. So, yeah, he was in that World Juniors 1500s with Ingebrigtsen, the young fella. Like, he's legit, this guy. So, yeah, so that was good. Good to train with a few people. Probably noticed the altitude a bit early on. Like, I feel like you blow it a bit too hard in the first minute of every rep, but then by two and a half minutes, you kind of settle down a bit more. Went out for the Arvo run with the group. There was a bit of lightning throughout the afternoon, and there was a couple of fires that started from the lightning, and we kind of ran that afternoon loop to where they were kind of working on one of the fires there. That didn't turn into anything special. Then Wednesday, ran by myself again. Listened to Kate Smythe and Soph Ryan on one of the episodes we put out, I think it was last Saturday, maybe the Saturday before, all about women's hormones and stuff like that. I learned a stack of stuff. Even for a guy listening to that stuff, I totally recommend it if you want to understand the female body and how that can affect performance and running and all that kind of stuff. It was one of those ones that you listen to and you're like, I feel like I should be paying for this kind of content. So that was Wednesday morning. Wednesday night, we decided to leave Falls Creek. So we got a watch and act warning just through like the app on our phones. And probably at the time, we thought we're kind of overreacting. Like nobody else seemed to leave on that Wednesday night there. And there was a bit of smoke coming into the valley. And I kind of just packed up half my stuff thinking that we'd probably go back up to the mountain. We kind of had our relatives just near Myrtleford. So we kind of decided to drive down there, stay with them for the night on Wednesday night, leave a bit of stuff up the top there. And if we had to, we could get back and get it, or we could go home from there. But the fires got worse on the Thursday, this is now. And everyone ended up having to be evacuated from there or leaving there by Friday morning. So we stayed at Carly's relatives for Thursday and Friday before heading back to Echuca. The smoke was super bad down there. And like they live probably 15 minutes out of Myrtleford on this country road. And there's like nowhere to run. And like smoke was super bad. And even Carly's uncle told me if I'm going to go for a run, make sure I look out for snakes and run in the middle of the road because there's snakes everywhere up there. He ended up shooting a red belly in one of the paddocks when we were up there one night. So I was like, nah, that's my decision made. I'm definitely not running because there's smoke and snake danger. So I pretty much had all of Thursday off, all of Friday off until we got home to Echuca, and it was like 43 degrees or something. I went out for like a 30-minute jog Friday night, did a workout Saturday morning. I did 5 400s off a minute, then a 15-minute threshold, and then another 5 by 400 meters. And I had 3 minutes between the fours and the threshold. So a good session, bit of a mix of everything. Quite enjoyed this one. It was super hot, so I just really made sure I relaxed in that threshold. I think I averaged maybe 3:24 pace. So usually when I'm kind of working at threshold pace, I'm kind of around 3:10, but I think it was like 35 degrees when I did the workout. Most of the fours were in 67s, which is pretty solid on the grass track up here. And yeah, that felt good. It was a good mixture of a workout. Felt like I was doing two workouts in one, in a way. And I was happy with how easy 67s were flowing, and I didn't really have to chuck it into that fifth gear. Was absolutely cooked when I was cooling down, though. Average 5:10s, Bradley. I'd love to see you do that one day for 2K only. That was a struggle of a warm down. And then on Sunday, met up with Archie Reed. We did 25K at 4:08 pace, just talking the whole way on the flat up here. And I did 7K in the afternoon for a 122K week. So still ticked the main things off, but when you miss probably three runs, it's probably the difference between doing 160K and 120K. So, Yeah, good, interesting week. Probably, interrupted, but no dramas in the main scheme of things when people are losing their houses and businesses and lives and all those kind of things. So we did not mind leaving. And I think when you got a baby and stuff now too, I was like, there's no way I'm risking sitting on top of this mountain with one curvy road in and out for running. It just did not make any sense. So we were straight out of there. And Jared Clifford and Tim Logan, because I left half my stuff up there, they ended up going into my apartment for me, gave them the code, went in there, got all my luggage that I left there, loaded up their car, and then drove that down the mountain for me and met them at Mount Beauty. So that was nice of them. Gave them a few sticks, beers to say thank you. Just said to the boys, empty the fridge, boys, load up the bags with the beers and you can have them.
Mm. That's not bad. You got a half marathon next week, Hobart. So
yeah, well, at the end of the week, like, I got two workouts, a 25k long run, you know, a couple of runs at altitude, some strides. Like, I've kind of nearly ticked every box. I only usually do two sessions a week anyway.
It's funny how you say, though, like, you know, you, with a baby and, you know, you're not going to stay up at falls, but I think this week's really put sort of things into perspective a little bit, because, like, when it's business as usual, running is, like, you know, the major priority and you've got the mileage that you want to hit, whereas this week I think you sort of realise that, oh, shit, there's more to life than running. And that's sort of, you know, the way that you're coming across now is, like, normally you'd be like, 122, shit week, but you're like, nah, in the scheme of things, it's all right.
I don't know, like, I'm glad Carly and the baby were there, because I'm not sure if I would have left. And then, like, not that it got that close to Falls Creek or anything, but I'm kind of glad that that's in your life now, and it kind of makes that decision for you. Like, we were, like, the minute our phones went off, we're like, we are out of here. Like, we overreacted massively, because some people didn't leave until, I think, Friday night or Saturday morning, whereas we're kind of, like, rushing down the staircase, loading the car. Like, I probably had a couple of beers at dinner and probably shouldn't have been driving down the mountain. But, we got there in the end. And as you said, Bradley, puts things into perspective.
Yeah.
And I hope it sort of serves as a bit of a warning for those that like to push the limits with that stuff, in terms of being a tourist, like, say, and ignoring advice and just praying for the best, when really they've been given advice from people that are absolutely in the know and are not just saying that as being really conservative. They're saying that because that's the advice that they're professionally giving at that time, for everyone to be safe. And I know there's a few cases of that around where people have, like, no, it's my holiday, I'm not ruining my holiday by leaving. And you're like, no, that's a fucking bad decision.
Yeah, and I think
just on the flips, like, I totally agree with you, Moose. But on the flip side, it's one thing, especially, like, when you're talking about a touristy area like the coast, it's one thing to say evacuate, but then there's nothing in place to manage people evacuating. Like, where it's like, okay, we'll leave Batemans Bay and we'll head up to Ulla Dulla. It was taking people 4 hours to get to Ulla Dulla, and then they're basically being turned around because they couldn't get through there. So it's like one thing to say evacuate, but then if there's things not in place for that to actually happen, people are like, well, what's the point of me evacuating then? You know, I've spent one day trying to leave and I've had to come back. You know, do I do that again?
I guess they don't really have a plan for that, is there? They're just...
No, because we're pretty much locked. A lot of time, you know, you're locked in. You couldn't get out south, you couldn't get out north, but they're saying leave.
Yeah.
It's what got me was, because we were sitting around watching the news every day, seeing if you were right, Brad, and then hadn't heard from you at this time, like, we probably were a bit anxious and a bit on edge as well. So when it kind of come to us and our phones were lighting up, we're like, nah, like, act on this one really quick. And there was one line in the warning that said something like, leaving immediately will always be the safest thing to do, or something like that. And we're like, okay, we're out of here, let's get down this mountain. So don't think I picked up any red blood cells, but we're all good. Is that what they are, red blood cells? Think they are, isn't it? Altitude.
Yep.
Let's thank some Patreon supporters, eh? Kick us off, Bradley. This person wrote their own description for you here. Have a read of this.
Yeah, so this guy's registered on Patreon as Asian Master. he's in his 60s. He's based in Hong Kong, and he competes in Hong Kong and around Asia over 800 meters and 800 to 5,000 meters on the track, and normally 5K on the road. And he also noted a few things from past Inside Running podcasts. So for Brady, he's noticed that Brady, you have a fear of meeting junkyard dogs and snakes on runs, which is in sync with Asian Master. He hates those things as well.
is Asian Master Gary Howard?
I don't think so. No, he didn't have a postal address.
Anonymous.
You keep looking. I'll search him again on Patreon here. Keep talking, right. Sorry.
Moose gets good points for knowing Rod McKinney's claim to fame.
First Australian under 220.
Yep. And then he's written, what is it, Selamat?
Selamat Antunia.
Yeah, what's that mean?
I think that's like congratulations.
Oh, okay.
Congratulations to me or something like that.
Yeah. And for me, he says that I should hang in there to collect some kudos and prize money that he's on offer for the over 40 years big dogs. So he's, So maybe I'll try and get fit for September when I turn 40 or end of August.
No postal address, but I got an email address here. That
AsianMaster@gmail.
No, Gary Howard email.
Probably might not say it here, but it ends in .hk.
Well, that sounds like Hong Kong, doesn't it?
It could be legit.
Well, thanks, Asian Master,
for your support. Yeah, for sure. Moose, who you got? Another international.
I have Andrea Castelnuovo.
Andrea, I think it is. It's a man.
Oh, Andrea. Andrea? It's a
Andrea,
man, is it?
Andrea.
From Italy. That lives in Barcelona. Isn't it?
Spelt like Andrea. Anyway, he lives in Barcelona, but he's from Como in Italy. Beautiful part of the world. Very nice lake. George Clooney has a house there. He studied international business at Tallinn University of Technology. We sent him an Inside Running podcast Steigen singlet. So you'll expect to see that in 3 more months. Even the Australian, actually on this, the Australian singlets will get there. The Australian post at the moment is not real efficient. 5K 17:52, 10K 36:25, half marathoner, 120. And he's run 2:56 for his marathon. So another sub 3 hour guy watching.
At the Zaragoza Marathon. How good's the name of that place over in Spain?
Zaragoza. Yeah, rolls off the tongue.
Zaragoza. I want to thank Barry Kerry. He's got some good PBs, some quick times. He's ran 16:36 for a 5K, 33:22 at the Lakeside 10K this year, 118 at the Burnley Half Marathon this year, and 3:26 at the Melbourne Marathon back in 2014. I reckon Barry's done a bit of training since then and would absolutely destroy that marathon PB of 3:26. He's a plumber by trade. I'm pretty sure he's real good mates with Harry Summers, if I've got the right guy. Barry, you know Barry?
Yeah, he is. Yeah, oh, yeah. He's definitely good mates with Harry.
Yeah.
So.
Beautiful, boys. Hey, thanks to all those patrons, all your support over the years, over the weeks. We really appreciate helping us bring the show out every week. Hey, running news, real light on. The only thing I've got is the Portsea Twilight 8K. Friend of the show, Jordan Williams, got the win in 22:13. His partner, Sarah Billings, she won the women's in 24:36. You guys got anything else?
Well, if we're going to do fun runs, then there are lots of other fun runs too.
Well, you see that Athletics Australia put this fun run on their like Instagram account. I've never seen like Athletics Australia put a fun run on their like their social media and stuff before.
Surely, Inside Running deserves a mention for winning Steigen #1 then.
Yeah, I don't think they did any posts at all about Steigen at all because it was organised like outside of Athletics Australia.
Well, was the Portsea race organized? Is that an AA race?
Well, I did some digging around today, and it's Soul Motive who owns like Run Melbourne and stuff as well. So, yeah, I couldn't work it out.
Individual athlete. That's what it is.
Oh, because there's big dogs racing there, you reckon, Moose? Sarah Billings, Jordan Williams.
Oh well. So Ali or Sinead might have got shout outs for their good runs in New York, that kind of thing, because they don't organise New York Marathon, but they still might make a shout out to it.
Don't know if I'd put in the same as Portsy Twilight 8K.
Is that Portsy Twilight run actually 8K?
Oh.
They're pretty quick times.
There aren't a lot of fun runs around that match the distance anymore. Unfortunately, people take shortcuts. I've learnt this the hard way.
Running gutters.
Any
other news, Moosh? You're going to tell us
Dawn Busters,
more fun
there was
runs?
Dawn Busters, Bell's Bash. They're the two main ones down the coast. There was that one in Fairhaven. There was the Roo Run. Shitloads, mate. But they're not worth talking about.
just say them anyway. All right, Brad, what's the question then? It is a slow week, though. There's not much happens this time of the year, race-wise.
Yeah, we might even get through two listener questions. We'll see how we go.
Yeah, that's why I put two in there. Oh, actually, before we move on, someone did ask about our training weeks, what shoes we're training in at the moment. I put that up in the weekly recaps up there.
Oh, yeah. I've got a good lineup at the moment.
Yeah, mine's pretty standard. Just maybe, so the last week, Brad, this might work real well for you because you haven't been doing workouts and stuff, but maybe Moose, kick us off. What, like the last run week, what shoes did you wear for what for what sessions and stuff?
All right. So for the easy runs, I ran in the New Balance 1080 V10, the Saucony Triumph, 17, the Asics Nimbus Lite, which is a new shoe. They're the three shoes that I jogged in this week. I did my sort of surge work in the New Balance Fuel Cell Rebel, and I did my threshold work and my 1K repeats in the Next Percent.
Oh, the Next Percent for workouts.
Well, I got a pair that's like got raced in already a few times, so it's ready to transition to a road shoe.
Yeah.
And we actually still have a few pairs of the Ekita Next Percent left. So if you're after a pair of Next Percents for your next race, send us a message.
Didn't sell as good as you thought they might have.
Ah, they're going real well. It's just we ended up with a few more. So, yeah, we post for free, actually. So if you're in Queensland and you're wondering, hey, shit, I need a pair of these bad boys, well, send us a message.
Yeah, Mattress,
wherever you're at.
Mattress was chasing a pair today when I was talking to him, actually, or yesterday.
Yeah, what size is his foot? Small, too.
Yeah, I don't know. But he said he tried to get him online, but gone.
Too Why quick. Would you support? So, all right, here we go.
He might not have known that you post him.
Here we go. Early.
Mattress is a great guy.
I know he's a legend, and he's bought stuff from me before. We love it. But this is something that people don't know about Nike, right? So when you go to the nike.com.au website, so you would assume that's an Australian branch of the company, right?
It comes from the Netherlands, doesn't it?
Not the case, exactly. So you're buying from overseas. It circumvents anything in Australia. So the staff in Australia don't get any piece of that pie. There's no taxes being paid. There's nothing. There's no benefit as an Australian to purchase that for the economy in Australia. And you're waiting long delays. Like I know people that have waited 2 weeks for product to come from the Nike website. It's just like it's not the Nike Australia website. We need to understand that. Yeah. And it's if you want a shoe, just send us a message. We post the shit for free. You'll have it in 2 days.
Yeah. Do you end up holding a pair for me?
Yeah, I got a pair for you. I'm waiting for you to pay. Perfect. I nearly sold them. You better be getting quick.
You haven't sent. Oh, do you send an invoice for that, or just pay over the phone or something?
No, I'm waiting for you.
All right. I'm running the Nike Peg Turbos at the moment, and I'm jogging in those, and I'm alternating those between a pair of Adidas Boost 20s, the NASA ones, good looking shoe as well. Using those for like my shorter runs. I haven't probably jogged in them longer than 35 minutes at the moment. They're kind of my 8K second run pair, just because I haven't worn them in the past. So far so good. Not as spongy as the Nike Peg Turbos, but still all right. Liking them and doing workouts in an old pair of my Lake Biwa marathon shoes. Actually, the Flyknit 4%ers. And doing some track work on the grass in an old pair of Streaks, which is that's my lineup at the moment. Four pairs, not as many as you, Moose. Brad, what are you wearing?
I covered my 30-odd K in Peg 35s during the week, and thongs from the house to the beach. They're the only shoes I've been wearing.
Unless you're like trying to save a house, then you'll put shoes
Ufos?
On.
Ufos? You in the Ufos?
Yep. I took them down the coast. Yep. The 4%er of thongs.
Yeah. Hey, that was my joke. I was going to use that next week on the show when we review them.
It's exactly what they felt like when you put them on.
Don't know. Yeah. We'll talk about them next week. Listener question, Brad. Let's go. Sorry.
All right. First one is coming from Peter Reynolds. Hi, guys. Love the show. And as I live in Castlemaine, it's got a local flavour to it. I have a listener question on shoes. How often do you guys wear trail-specific shoes as you do a fair bit of training on dirt roads and trails? I'm assuming all of your runs have a bit of tarmac at the start and end. When do you choose trail shoes over regular running shoes? Cheers, Pete. Well, I'll kick this one off. I've never owned a pair of trail shoes in my life. So although I run on trails, they're I guess fire roads. So they're pretty, you can run in normal training shoes on those. So never owned a pair of trail shoes.
Can you, Moose, maybe explain the difference between trail shoes and, like, the other shoes we're running, like the Peg Turbos or Adidas Boost 20s or whatever you said, like Saucony Triumphs, New Balance?
Trail shoes are a relatively new phenomenon, really. They've got big with the boom of the trail running scene. And you're right, Brad, like, people would just wear road shoes, but they would still run in the bush. But they never called themselves a trail runner and they never... considered it any different really to running on the road. But now there's a whole industry around trail running, and you've got groups like that have set up as trail runners because they run in the bush all the time. But the difference between a road shoe and a trail shoe, well, there's a few underneath the obvious thing is the tread. So when you've got a trail shoe, there's a lugged sole with normally a harder rubber and a stickier rubber. And the lugs are shaped differently, so when you're going uphill or on the flat, you bite in and you don't slip forward or backwards. And then the heel of the shoe or the rear foot, they're shaped the other way. So when you're going down a hill, you don't slip out onto your bum. They tend to be a little harder wearing under there in terms of like being on rocks and that kind of thing. And the soles normally are firmer, like the foams are firmer, because that gives a bit more stability when you're on technical terrain. If you take your real soft road shoe out and you go down a technical descent, you might feel really unstable, higher chance of rolling your ankle. So the midsoles normally are a higher density, very often neutral shoes for trail shoes. So some people wear support shoes when they run on the road, and that's because it's like a really repetitive activity. And there's repetitive loading that way. But if you're on a trail, every footstep's different to the one before it. And so there's less use of those kind of overuse injuries. And so you worry less about the foot sort of or pronation be causing a drama and more about stability in the shoe. So a neutral base is better. It doesn't you're not as prone to the foot rolling outwards in a neutral shoe. The uppers are tougher. So less tearing, the shoe should last longer, lets less grit into the shoe through the mesh, and holds your foot on the platform more. So if you go down a really steep descent or you're on quite a bermy cambered surface and you're in your road shoe, really flexible meshes, your foot isn't held on the platform very well, whereas as a trail shoe, more rigidity. And you feel like you're more contained in the shoe, so you get more confidence when you're descending or when you're off camber.
Yeah, I do own a pair. When I was down Hobart a couple of years ago, Andy Allison was working for the Running Edge, and they had some on sale, so I bought a pair. But I think I've only worn them once, just a bit too
long. What are they?
New Balances.
Oh, the Hiero?
I couldn't tell you. They've got a bit of yellow on the bottom, orange. They're a good shoe, but I just have no reason to wear them because everything's like just dirt roads, like not so rocky or anything.
So, Moose, you run on trails a lot. At what point would you suggest you'd have to go from a road shoe to a trail shoe to, I don't know, like see some benefit? Because you do most of your running in road shoes, don't you?
Yeah, I do most of it. So if I was spending more than 50% of my time on a single track, I would probably put trail shoes on.
If I'm on a fire road that's well groomed, it'll be a road shoe. If it's really wet, I might even put a trail shoe on for wet dirt roads if they're kind of muddy.
Hadn't thought of that. Yeah. Good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I was slipping around a bit this morning just on my trails because it had rained overnight. I probably should have worn those trail shoes.
Yeah, you get it. I don't know what trail shoe they are, but there used to be a real stigma about trail shoes being heavy and clunky, and they were really like they were an afterthought for shoe companies, and now there's a lot of focus that gets put on them, and they're actually quite nice running shoes. Like there's a bunch in our store that I would love to run in, and I like they're fun shoes. They're a second shoe for someone. They're not normally someone's first shoe. So, but what people make the mistake of, we see it all the time, is they come in and they're like, you know, I saw this shoe, it's got the best grip. And you're like, yeah, well, it's pretty narrow. No, it's got the best grip. My mate wears it. He doesn't slip anywhere, rah, 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 so I want to try that. You're like, you've got a wide foot and this is a narrow shoe. The grip doesn't mean shit when your foot gets sore after 10 minutes. So people focus on features in the shoe without actually concentrating on how the shoe fits.
Hey, grip isn't everything.
Yeah, and then they blame the shoe. Oh, that's a shit shoe. It's terrible. Like, no, you just fucking picked it because the lugs are deep, not because it fits your foot or you like the feel of it. People do that with trail shoes more than any other type of shoe.
Mm. Good answer. Feel like I've learned something there, Bradley.
Yeah, it was good.
Would reckon put Laura's on for next week because we've still got a bit to get through tonight.
You're the boss.
I think so. Moose on the loose.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
Just did it, didn't you?
Shoe tip. Fuck, yeah. Good.
I thought I was having a crack at people that don't buy local.
Oh, no, I'm not having a crack at that. I'm just saying, like, there's no difference in price. Why wouldn't you get it local?
I know, but the tone of your voice is very moose on the loose. So I just thought you could almost pass. That could almost pass.
Let's pass it.
All right. There's a bit coming up. Well, I've got to go Hobart Marathon first, Brad, because you and I are going down there this weekend.
Yeah.
Both our names are on the elite start list.
Yeah, well, I only entered actually today and I wasn't even sure what event I was going to enter. But luckily, the event that I've entered in is the one that put me on the start list for.
That's good.
The half.
There's a marathon, there's a half, there's a 10K. No elite start list for the 10K. Big name on this start list is probably Millie Clark in the half marathon. Waiting to see what Millie's going to do on the way to possibly qualifying for Tokyo. So this might tell us a bit. She'd be going into the half marathon as the red hot favourite. She'll probably, the press release I read today, she'll break the course record, which is, I think, 74 minutes. She'll win a bit of cash down there. Benny Saint on the pacing duties in the marathon. That's interesting. Pacing his fiancée, Katie, who's going for a Olympic qualifiers trial time. 2:45, I think, for females in the States. I got that right? 2:48, 2:45?
Don't know. Not sure.
Wait, what was that? Sorry?
What time do the women have to run in the States to go to their trials? 2:45?
Oh, yeah, I think it's about that.
2:46, something like that. Miriam Dowley's on there, Kristen Malloy, Paige Gilchrist, men's race, Michael Marantelli, patron supporter, Nick Earle, Brian Lyons, Adam Bishop. Ben St. Lawrence is there, but he's pacing. So I'd say Nick Earle might pick up that one pretty easy, boys. Any comments about that?
Just a tempo for him.
Train and run, just wants to break 2:20 and pick up some cash, I think. I think you get a bit of extra cash if you go under 2:20.
Yeah, well, that's what he'll be there for.
That's what he told me last week. Just do an easy 2:19. They spelled my name wrong here, Brad, as well, on this one. Trelfall. Didn't pick that up. Brady Trelfall, Brad Croker, Dave Ridley, Tom Middleton.
Is this ordered in terms of rankings?
Yeah, I don't know. Nah,
look, Dave shouldn't be.
Dave Ridley's quicker than me, so is Brad Croker.
Ridley's going to World Cross.
World half, you mean?
I mean World half, sorry.
I can confirm red that I will not favorite. Be finishing I won't be finishing that high up.
Dave Ridley, red hot favourite with that 65, I reckon he's the man to beat.
I reckon you're the man to beat, Brady.
His PB is like 45 seconds quicker than me over a half.
Yeah, but look at the form you're in.
Yeah, true. I'm looking forward to race. I think it's been a month since Zatopek this weekend. Looking forward to getting back on the line, towing it down there. See if I can run a 65, something be nice, Bradley. Get in the 65s, see what happens. Whole lot of bushfire fundraisers, running related, I'm going to talk about here. Dave McNeil, he's done a post yesterday, donate $1 for every kilometre you run this week. And it's gone, everyone I've seen on Instagram and Strava, it's gone everywhere the last 24 hours. Yeah, pretty good, isn't it? Dave McNeil, smart guy, kind guy, generous guy, good thinking guy, to come up with this idea. Because it's not a huge amount of money, but if a lot of people can do this, it's going to contribute fantastically to the fundraising efforts for these Australian bushfires. So I've signed us three up, boys. We're going to do it. We should be able to, you know, maybe do 3 by 150k weeks. Brad, you'll be right for that.
Yeah, so I was thinking about this because I'm not sure how much I'm actually going to run this week with the conditions here. But I was thinking that on the 1st of December, I ran down on Runningford Road. I did 28k as my long run with Matt Johnson, who was actually he was evacuated out of Browlea and had to spend a night at the evacuation centre, and Andrew McGowan. So I thought what I would do is maybe donate $1 for every kilometre that I've run from that point up until now, which I think is 210.
Oh, good work.
Yeah. Because yeah, cool. I won't run a lot this week. So yeah.
Moose will come close to 200k this week, the rate you're going.
Yeah, I'm going to aim for a big week, so hopefully that gets up there.
Any listeners out there, definitely get on board that. Samantha Gash also hit us up this morning. She's, what's the best way to describe her, Moose? Trail, ultra? She was on the Rich Roll podcast. She's like a massive name in the trail world, isn't she?
Influencer.
Keynote speaker. She's organising a virtual half marathon, $50 entry. All money goes to the Red Cross. It's going to happen on the weekend of January the 17th, 18th. We'll put some links in the show notes there as well. And a whole lot of race directors from the Victorian trail running scene have got together to come up with a bit of a raffle. So you pretty much buy a raffle ticket, and there's over 30 races in a prize pool. So if you get pulled out, I think maybe first prize is maybe 5 entries of your choice. And then it goes down different places, different amount of races you can get into for free. So heaps of cool things going on in the running community. If that's one thing I've learned this last couple of days, is how people kind of stick together and help out their mates and stuff, which is pretty cool. Anything else coming up, Moose? What's going on in your life down in Ballarat for the next week?
I mean, the highlight will be the shooting of the movie begins this week. So we'll be I'll be on set for the shooting of the movie, which will be pretty cool in Geelong and Ballarat. Actually, one of the guys that plays the Greek fella who comes like third or something in the race, Joel Tobin-White, actor, runner.
Yeah, like, has he got heaps of lines and stuff, like bigger role?
Nah, but he's in a lot of running scenes. He gets passed up Heartbreak Hill. Like, this Korean guy buries him up the hill, so he's going to have to put on a bit of a show for that.
When are you going to Bendigo to film?
No, I'm not going to Bendigo.
Oh, don't do that stuff. Half of Falls Creek's in Bendigo at the moment training.
They're down the coast. They should have gone down the coast. That's where the training's at right now.
I think most of them in Falls Creek. Bats are recruiting hard down there.
For a Div 2 win.
Yep, Div 2. Heard it here first. Oh, that's pretty exciting stuff then. That'd be good.
Oh, it'll be interesting.
Seen the cast list too, haven't you? Any other big names?
No other big names.
Joel Tobin-White, he hasn't done much running, has he, recently? Is he back training?
Yeah, apparently he's back going all right. So, yep, he'll be the problem will be, like, for a bloke like him who's professional runner, is, like, long days of shooting can mean really tiring, fatiguing stuff for an actor who has to physically exert themselves like that, especially running up a hill all fucking day. And it's going to be hot, and there's, like, they're wearing these canvas shoes. Yeah, it's not ideal, but apparently well compensated.
Hey, how many days are they filming for, though?
I think I just saw the final thing. Hold on. I think he's scheduled for hold on 1 second. I'll tell you.
He'll have to tell me all this stuff.
And while you're finding that out, Moose, I want to know, now that you've scouted the places, what are you needed for?
Oh, mate, I didn't do anything when I literally didn't do a thing.
What are you doing? Are you giving the runners technique advice or?
No, I think I'm there to make sure they don't cook them. They're real worried about OH&S having them run up a hill like when it's 30 degrees all day. They're really worried about it. Like, yeah, I think it's a big deal.
They obviously didn't listen to the episode a couple of weeks ago where you cooked Brady.
I haven't done anything good since then.
How are you qualified to make that call?
I literally have had no impact. No one asked me. I just kind of hide. I'm the gray man. I've just hidden at the back, and the Koreans have it all sorted. I don't know.
As if Moose is going to say no to money, though.
Yeah. Oh, I don't even know. Nah, it's not like that. I just want to get my name on a screen. Credits. Vietnamese.
In the credits.
I wonder what my name in Vietnamese looks like.
Mate, you got your name on a running singlet.
Oh, it's been good too. Sold out.
The Steiger ones.
Yeah, the Steiger ones.
Done. That's nice.
They went well.
Yeah, good. Yeah. Keep the same uniform next year or change it up, you reckon?
Change it up. Change it.
I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Have you got yours, Brady?
Yeah, I got mine. It was here when I got home from Falls Creek. Mum was house sitting. She collected it for me, which was nice. Mum's still here, though. I haven't got rid of her. I told her she was going to be here for 2 weeks, and then she thinks she's still staying for 2 weeks.
Did it fit? A bit small?
I haven't put it on yet.
Yeah.
I was thinking about racing in it, but then I'm like, yeah, racing a singlet with your own name on it. I'm like,
Nick Earl races with fucking shorts with his own name on it.
Yeah, there's a bit of a difference between Nick Earl and I.
What's the difference?
Swagger. That's the difference.
Yeah, true.
Interview boys, Jared Clifford, caught up with him a couple of weeks ago and, said his name a few times here. Jared and I had done a podcast episode like years ago when I was doing Tell Me Your Tales, so didn't talk about any of that, like how he got into running, to go through his kind of whole biography, more just current stuff. You've heard his name a couple of times tonight, obviously coming off that double gold medal at the World Para Championships. Talk about all the logistics about, you know, Tim Logan's role and how they do that swap with the band and, how they prepare for all that stuff. Jared's always got some good input about, you know, the state of athletics and especially para athletics and, gearing up for a big Tokyo. This guy could, well and truly win a couple of gold medals at the Paralympics coming up in like 6 months' time. So enjoy this chat with him, and we'll see you guys next week.
See you, boys. In Hobart, Brady.
Yeah, hey, are we on the same flight or not? Luck.
Nah, but we arrived similar time.
Okay, so you're not on the same flight as me from Melbourne, nah?
I don't think so. Are you Qantas?
Nah, mate, Jetstar. Pockets aren't as deep as yours.
We're different. We don't have Jetstar from Canberra.
All right. See you, boys.
See ya.
See ya. It's all the same, I'll keep on walking under a
cover of my skin. I put on all your names. All right, this week on the Inside Running Podcast, I'm joined with Jared Clifford, who's just fresh off his 2 gold medals at the World Para Championships over in Dubai. Thanks for coming on the Inside Running Podcast, Jared. What's been happening?
Thanks for having me on. I got back on Friday from being overseas, so I'm just settling back into day-to-day life. But yeah, I've been a long-time listener of the show, so it's good to be on.
And I was just saying off-air to you that we will let listeners know that Jared and I have done a podcast together before on my other podcast, Tell Me Your Tales. That was September 14th, 2017. So if you want to go back and hear about how Jared got into the sport, his kind of achievements up until that stage, definitely go back and check that out for a bit of context, because we're going to talk about Jared in 2019 in this conversation. But yeah, definitely check that one out if you want. And where have you been, Jared? We just said you're back to Australia. Where you been traveling?
Yeah, so we were in Flagstaff for the first month, just training, and then had a training camp in Barcelona before heading to Dubai for the World Championships. And then I decided to take a little bit of a mental break from the training before we get into Tokyo. And so I went to London, Paris and Edinburgh. So I've been to quite a bit of the world.
Has this, after the World Champs, this been a bit of a party kind of trip, or you just been chilling out, like any running involved at all?
We had a big night or two in Dubai, but mainly just chilling out, really. Not too much partying, and it was a big lead into the championship, so I was pretty tired, and just like the pressure and everything can get to you after a while, so it was good to just kick back and relax.
Beautiful, mate. Well, I'm going to read through your PBs. Tell me if I get these ones correct, and then we might explain to the listeners like your classification, because I've got a couple of questions around that as well, and just kind of how some of the things you've got to deal with when you're competing. So 800, 153?
Yep.
Okay. 1500, 345 in Sydney?
Yeah, yeah. So that's the one that there's a bit of contention about, because obviously my win at World Champs was a couple of seconds slower, but that's the world record. So
yeah, I was going to ask that, because that one's got you listed as like a T12 world record, but then your world record at World Champs, the 3:47, was like T13.
Yeah, so that's, I mean, when we get to classification, I can clear that up, but some races just aren't ratified for some reason, and some are. So I've run under that time, I think, a dozen times, but none of them have counted.
Yeah, okay. We'll talk a bit more about that later on. A mile in 4:09, 3K in 8:15. That's correct?
Yeah, that was a while ago, but yeah.
Yeah, still claiming. 5K in 14:22.
Yeah.
10K on the road, 29:44 at Albert Park this year on a windy day. I remember that one because I was with you for the first couple of K, which is super impressive, that 29:44.
Yeah, that's got to be one of my favourite PBs, I think, definitely.
And I did some digging around for your half marathon today, and is it 70:47 as maybe a training run at Burnley half marathon?
Yeah, that was this year, just to, you know, get out in the club colours.
Get some points for Diamond Valley.
Yeah, I love getting out in the club colours. I did quite a lot of the races, or as many as I could get to this year, so it's always good fun.
Yeah, so now can you maybe explain to us like what your classification is and what it actually means? Like, is it juvenile macular degeneration?
Yeah, so that's my condition. I was diagnosed when I was 3, so I have trouble seeing in the central part of my vision, so my perception of detail is what I struggle with. So stuff like facial features or anything like that is really hard for me to pick up on. So there's 3 visual impairment categories: T11, T12, and T13. And T11 is totally blind. That's pretty easy to classify. And then T12 and T13 are vision impaired. So there's still some useful sight. And for distance running, because we don't have to run in lanes, they combine 12 and 13. So it's pretty simple for distance running. There's just like a totally blind category and then a vision impaired category.
Okay, so is that why you've moved from like T12 to T13, because your eyesight's like deteriorated a bit?
So T12 is actually worse. So I've always been T12, but at international level, they just combine the two categories, so it comes under the heading of T13. So that's why there's all that confusion with the records, because for some reason, I think it's just coincidence, T12s tend to actually run quicker than 10:13s with the records. So instead of just combining the world record, they have separate ones for some reason, despite the fact that we compete together internationally.
Yeah, that's good to clear that up. And like, explain to me, what can you see when you're competing? Maybe on the track first, because I want to then talk to you about like what it's like on the road and cross country as well. I'm sure it's a bit different.
Yeah, so track's obviously quite a lot easier because 100 meter straights, 100 meter bends, it's always the same. The difficulty is running in a pack. So I still run the 1500 solo. So pretty much I can see the person in front in terms of where they are and their movement and stuff like that. But in terms of seeing the bibs or who they are or anything beyond that person, it's pretty much impossible. So quite often I won't have a clue what place I'm coming in a race or how fast I'm going or anything like that, and in different conditions when it's darker, it's, you know, even hard to see the feet in front of me to avoid clipping them. So a lot of the time it feels like I'm running into an unknown kind of abyss-ish kind of thing, but I also use my ears so I can hear the person in front as well, which then I can gauge where I am.
So are there races when you cross the line and you're not actually sure what position you're finished in?
Oh, most of the time, yeah, right. Really. Unless I've been at the front of the race from the start, and then I can just know if someone's passed me, I usually won't have a clue.
And do you think it's sometimes a good thing, like not knowing sometimes can help you out because it doesn't like get in your head as much? Like you could be sitting next to Luke Matthews or Ryan Gregson, and I'm sure you have been in some of these national races, and it's not like you're psyched out because they're, you know, 3:30 kind of low guys.
Oh, I think it helps a lot of the time, because the other thing is, once the person in front of me gets a couple of meters ahead, I don't know how far ahead they've got. So if I can't see anyone with a lap to go and I know there's people out there, I'm probably going to fight all the way to the line just in case I do catch them, even if in reality they're pulling away, because I just don't know. So it kind of helps you to never give up, I think, in the race. And yeah, I think just being a Paralympian and a para-athlete, it's kind of like that inevitable underdog label. So whenever I'm in a national final next to people like, you know, a Luke Matthews and a Ryan Gregson, it's kind of feels like I've got nothing to lose and I'm just going out there and giving it a crack.
Well put. And then, like, tell me, what's it like? I was tracking you a bit at the Bundoora 10K cross-country race this year. Like, what's it like in that race?
There's a funny story to that. I was just supposed to jog around and get points for the club, but my training partner and guide, Tim Logan, pretty much told me to stop being soft and to have a crack. And the plan was that I would sit on his tail and I'd just follow him throughout the whole race, and, you know, hopefully I could just get around safely by watching his footsteps and stuff. But he's quite fit, so he dropped me after about 4K and I was on my own. So that was really difficult. I think I ran out of the flags heaps of times. I pretty much hip and shouldered one of the officials, and it was probably not the best thing for me to do in terms of the risk that it was giving me. But I love cross country. I love getting out there, and I don't know, it's just like such a pure form of running. So I think for me, getting out there and doing that is sometimes more important than, you know, always being wrapped up in cotton wool and just running on the track. But in terms of its difficulty, I think the adrenaline was what got me through it, and also the people out there. Like, with 400 to go, I caught Liam Cashin from Western Athletics, and he pretty much guided me around the last corner, which, you know, it's still a race, it's a state title, like they don't have to do that, and I'm just lucky that in Victoria I've got, you know, such good support.
Yeah, you fit in pretty well in Victoria with that kind of, like, there's a massive group of youngsters. Like, you're 20 years, is that right?
Yeah, there's such a good group.
And, like, it's almost like there's a no-fear kind of attitude as well amongst all of them. Like, Liam Cashin you just mentioned, and, like, Cody Shanahan, and, like, all these guys are just having a crack. I know we spoke on the podcast a couple of times, giving Brad a bit of shit about, like, just how strong our kind of those junior kids are down here that are now in the open ranks.
Oh, yeah, I think that's something that Victoria is really good with. And the cross-country season, I think, is what builds that, because, you know, people like Cody and Liam, I've grown up racing them for years, and I think we've always been the youngest in the races, and we've just fed off each other. You know, one of us will have a crack against the big guys and do really well, and that'll, you know, feed the belief that, you know, I can do that, or another person can do that. And I think that no fear is just a thing that a runner needs to have, and I think if we have fear, we won't get as far as we probably should be getting.
Yeah, well put. And like, you obviously use that winter season with the Albert Park 10K, and I know you ran Gels Park relays and Sandown relays, both of those with a guide, as a bit of a base building thing for before you went over to Flagstaff.
Yeah, it's the first time that I've spent the entire winter in Australia since I was, I think, 15 or 16, just because I'm always traveling overseas for a championship. So with the championship being so late, it actually gave me my first full winter. So building a base for the first time really in my career was really beneficial, and also getting the guiding practice. Like, although Harry Summers and Jack Itter from Diamond Valley weren't going to guide me at Dubai, it was still practice. And at Albert Park, I couldn't manage to get a guide because it's such a good race. They all want to run it themselves, understandably. So I had a guy on a bike, but just listening to the instructions and trying to tune out from stressing about stuff was really good practice for Dubai, and I think they played a pretty pivotal role.
And did you have that kind of time in mind at Albert Park, like the 29:44? And like, that's a tough course for someone who has trouble with their vision to go around the cones. It's probably what, four or five times you've got to do U-turns on that course.
Yeah, so I think if you're in that ballpark, you're kind of always aiming for sub 30. Whether or not you think it's actually possible is another question. And in hindsight, I have no idea what I was thinking. But that course is interesting because once you get around those turnarounds, I just thought it was, you know, out and back pretty easy, not many obstacles. But the corner is such a slow trajectory around, like it curves around the lake. The guy on the bike was having to, yeah, tell me to take a step to the side every now and then just because I wasn't quite predicting the trajectory the same. But with the turnarounds, we were just counting it in, so 100, 50, 20, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And at 1, that's when I turn, and I think I only hit one of the cones once, which is pretty good. I think the guy on the bike used to do rally car driving or something like that, the navigation. I think someone told me that, so I was in pretty safe hands.
Who organises that? Like, do you find him yourself, or like, does someone put you in touch? And like, obviously, I didn't realise. I thought it was just an Athletes Victoria official kind of on the bike helping out for the morning, but it sounds like he was pretty qualified to do that job.
Well, I have a pretty loose partnership with Crosby Crew, and I really like everyone down there. And Tim Crosby has helped me out quite a lot throughout my career. So I just asked him if he knew anyone that, you know, would be suitable. And Tim Crosby knows quite a lot of people. So I think he just picked the best qualified person that wasn't planning on racing that day, which was him. So it was so good to have him by my side, and I'd only met him on the morning of the race, and usually I feel like I have to trust the person with my life, but he instilled that in me pretty much straight away, so I was, you know, quite trusting of him.
Beautiful. So you wrap up the winter season for Athletics Victoria, head to Flagstaff. How many weeks were you over there for?
It was pretty much a month, so it was my longest stint by a few days up there, and the first time, you know, that was my third time going, so it was my first time where I really felt like I adjusted quick enough and was able to train to my full potential up there.
Yeah, what's it like as a place to visit? Like, there's a bit more going on in Flagstaff than some training altitude centres, isn't there? Like, places to go?
Yeah. I haven't been to a lot of other places, but I think, you know, Philo, through his work, has been to pretty much every altitude training place in the whole world, and he swears by Flagstaff. It's nearly a small city. Like, it's a pretty big town, and there's heaps to do. It's on a plateau, but then you can also get hills within 10 minutes if you wanted that. There's so many running trails, whether it's single track or you know, a dirt road, and there's tracks. There's like three or four tracks as well. There's a really good physiology lab. It's the perfect place to train, and it's at 2,100 meters, which is probably the perfect altitude. But then again, we also did runs at 2,700, and it's easy to drop down to 1,000 meters down at Sedona and Cottonwood, which both have tracks. So it's if I was serious about a major championships, now that I've been there, I probably wouldn't go anywhere else.
Yeah, and like, can you explain the group that goes? Because I think you guys have been over. Yeah, I think you just said three times. Like, it seems like Philo has a group that goes over there every year. Is that like an Athletics Australia kind of group, or how does that work?
Yeah, so some years we've had people that aren't coached by Philo, and that's worked really well. But this year, obviously, there's not many people that will be going to altitude at that time of year. So we just had, you know, the para group, which was me, Michael Roger, Dion Kenzie, Sam Harding, who's another vision impaired runner who's just got to qualify for Tokyo. Myself and Tim, who was guiding me, plus Athletics Australia had funded Dane Verwey to come as our physio, and Millie Clark and Keely Small, our, you know, kind of Olympic contenders. So our squad's growing quite a lot at the moment. When we're over there, we can pretty much now have our own group, and it's enough training partners.
And you're all in like one house and stuff? They rent out a house, or how's that work?
Yeah, all in one house, so we're all crammed in. It's pretty big, two stories, but in a month, it can get pretty cooped up, but Flagstaff's just so good, so you can always get away.
Yeah, good. And then, like, you're there for 4 weeks, and you're obviously preparing for a 1500 and a 5K. So, what does training look like for those 4 weeks when you're up there?
Yeah, so sometimes I'd be doing, you know, a session that, you know, take warm up and cool down out of it. Might only total 1200 meters or 1500 meters of work, and then the next day I'd be doing a session that could total up to 20Ks of, you know, with Farlek in the middle. So. The training was really different, but it's also the first time I've gone to Flagstaff with a bit of pressure as well. I've always gone into championships being someone not really in contention to win, whereas this time I was going in with the mentality that to not win would be a disappointment. So you kind of really take notice of how you're feeling in every session. And you know, I had a session where I went out too hard in a speed workout, and I could hardly even finish the session, and I was throwing up everywhere. And it's any session can derail your confidence, or any session can really build it up. So by the end of it, it's nearly a fine line between what sessions are gonna gain fitness or which sessions are gonna, you know, build up your confidence.
And are you putting that pressure on yourself, or are you feeling it from other people?
I think it's a bit of both, but I think I focus more on the pressure that I naturally put on myself, which, you know, obviously I've got big goals with Tokyo, and this is, you know, the first time I'll be racing people from my classification in 2 years. So Dubai was a really good chance to kind of gauge where I was at against the rest of the world, and Russia was coming back into it for the first time in my career. So there was a lot of unknowns, and I think in the able-bodied running community back home, the people that would be following my journey, you know, they hear that I'm the world record holder, and they hear that I want to win gold in Tokyo, but there's a lot more to it. So, yeah, I think that's the pressure I'm putting on myself, but also medal tallies. You know, I'm paid by Athletics Australia to win medals, and there's an expectation on me to do that. So I think there's a pressure there, although they'll never really put it on me specifically. You know, that's kind of what your job is to do.
Yeah, like all that funding and performance means so much for you guys. We see it all the time, like people go on and off that kind of NAS funding because of their results at recent championships.
Yeah, that's right. And also the funding that the sport gets can often be dictated by how many medals are won at a Paralympic Games or something like that.
So sometimes
like we don't know how much it does dictate it, but I'm sure whether I win medals in Tokyo potentially will dictate, I don't know, extra bonus funding for the sport. I'm not really sure how it works, but I know that there's added pressure on people in the staff as well.
And you're a switched on and smart guy as well, and you'd realise, like, you winning medals brings exposure, which then brings funding, and then that's, you know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of expectations on your shoulders when you start thinking about all those kind of things, sponsorship and all that kind of stuff, not just for you, but for the whole sport in general.
Yeah, that's the thing. The Paralympic Games are growing so quickly. I think sometimes I feel as though if I can win these gold medals, because obviously I want to win them just because I want to, but other than that, if I win a gold medal, maybe it gives me a better platform to get the messages that I think are important. You know, maybe that'll help me get them across. So there's that extra pressure, and it's also with Tokyo next year, I know that if I can win a gold medal, then the next 4 years will be so much more bearable, maybe, or easier to just get through, and I'll be able to focus on, you know, having ticked that box, I might be able to focus more on a little bit of activism kind of area of the sport too. So there's a lot going on in my head.
Yeah, because a Paralympic gold medal looks a whole lot better. Like, not that a world champs, two of those gold medals isn't impressive, but it's a good thing to have on the resume, isn't it?
Oh, 100%. And I think that's the thing after the races in Dubai that I was nearly nervous about. Everyone was celebrating. I was celebrating. But in the back of my mind, it was like those races were so perfect at world championships. So I wish just one of them had, you know, would be the race in Tokyo. So it's kind of like it's you know, I want to celebrate now, but the turnaround's so quick and it doesn't really feel like the job's done at all. So
well, let's talk about your championship history. Like, you were seventh at the Paralympics in Rio, I've got that correct?
Yeah, yeah.
And then you got the bronze medal at the World Champs in 2017 at London. So as you said, this one's kind of been coming, moving up the kind of the finishing order, and now to jump to the two golds and, you know, leading into Tokyo, it must, you know, as you just said, had that added pressure, but it must also give you a lot of confidence knowing you're the fastest guy in the field with those world records, but also that you can perform at a championship now as well.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I think, you know, I don't know if, it's, you know, I think it is Philo's coaching as well as my mentality before these races, but I've never not been able to peak for the peak that I want to, you know, whether that's once or twice a year. So my national championships and my major championships in the winter overseas have always been my best races of the year. And I don't know if that's just because I can get the most out of myself when it's on the line or if I perform well under pressure and feel those periodization, but it gives me confidence every time I ace what I'm aiming for the whole year, because then it makes it more likely that I can do it when it matters in Tokyo. But being the fastest going in definitely had a pressure that I was just learning to deal with, you know, this year, and obviously making the World Junior Championships for able-bodied last year and breaking the world record also made people look to me, despite having never proved myself at a major championship yet. So there was a bit of unknown. So now that I've done it, I think going into Tokyo, I'll be, yeah, definitely more confident, and at least now I know that I can do it, so I've just got to do it again.
How have you seen the para sports change over those kind of three championships?
Oh, massively. In Doha, it was, you know, there was no crowd, not much viewing. In London, which is, you know, the home of Paralympics spectatorship, we had upwards of 30,000 to 40,000 people coming to a World Championships for para-athletics on the weekend nights. And then obviously Rio was huge, but you know, Tokyo, my family might struggle to get tickets. That's how many tickets they've sold already. So that's awesome. And Dubai, it was on Channel 7, the app live and highlights on the actual TV, and we're getting heaps more exposure. And I think people are starting to realize that in the world we live in today, where, and this is something Kurt Fearnley will always say, is that we live in a world where the image of perfection is becoming so more a part of society, and the Paralympics are showing that there is a lot of beauty and strength in a perceived imperfection. So I think the growth of the Paralympic Games is going to be so good for the world as a whole.
Yeah, and it was always after, like, the London Olympics as well, and Paralympics, wasn't it? Like, that was the first time. I know their marketing around that was really good, and they had that YouTube video, and we probably spoke about it last time you were on the podcast, but that, for me, was a massive shift about this needs to be celebrated, not kind of turned away from.
Yeah, and it's incredible when you go to London. Their Paralympians, especially from 2012, are household names, and in Japan, they're making them household names before the games have even happened. So that's, you know, just as Olympians are household names. So that's incredible. And I think what the most powerful part of the Paralympic Games is to show that when sport adjusts and shows what people with disability can do, then community can adjust. And maybe, you know, our workplace and our governments will have more people with disability, because we should be celebrating that human diversity, and increasingly we are, but there's obviously a lot more to do.
Yeah, and like looking at those countries and what they're doing, are there certain things, I'm putting you on the spot a bit here, that you kind of look at those countries and think, oh, I wish Australia was doing this or that?
Oh, I think, you know, obviously Australia's would be one of the better countries in the world, but I think having the games come to the country does so much for people with disability in that country.
Yeah.
And so obviously they have a very good excuse to be putting, you know, posters on the side of buildings with, you know, someone in a wheelchair or someone using a cane on an ad. Just little stuff like that, because often you can grow up in Australia, and it's changing now with people like Dylan Alcott and Madison De Rosario and people like that. But when I was growing up, I could easily have gone my whole childhood without hardly ever seeing someone with a visible disability. And I think to normalize it, it just has to be seen a lot more, and people will be able to, because you know, some people are scared of what they don't know, and if they don't know disability, then they'll be scared of it. So I think that's it's this first simple step is just seeing it more in society and seeing that it's just another way of living, and it's, you know, it's not the end of the world.
Yeah, when I was reading Dylan Alcott's book, he kind of spoke about the only time when he saw somebody in a wheelchair was when it might have been one of the TAC kind of car ads, and someone had been in a car accident, and then they're kind of saying, you know, don't drink and drive or you'll end up like this person who's in a wheelchair. And that was such a negative kind of way to show someone with a disability, and that was all he was getting exposed to. So then his thinking about, you know, his kind of self-image is persuaded in this way.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And when I'm growing up, I'm told to, I was told to hide my disability as much as I could, not by my parents, but by just the vision impaired school teachers. And it's not their fault at all, because when vision impaired people, there's such a high unemployment rate, despite a lot of them having degrees. And that's just because even if they look so good on paper, as soon as they walk into the meeting, often the person will change their attitude. And Nas Campanella, who's the newsreader for Triple J, she's a great example of that. She's one of the best journalists in Australia, and she got rejected by heaps of job people who'd given her an interview and stuff like that. So society needs to shift quite a lot, and I think it is going in that direction. But yeah, just portraying it not as a negative thing, but as something to celebrate and just a challenge to overcome, I think that'd be so special.
Yeah, I think we're on the right track now. Like, it's still got a bit of time to happen, but I think it's the ship sailing in the correct direction.
Yeah, definitely.
So back to your races. We're kind of jumping all over the place here, mate. But the 1500, you go in with the quickest time. You hit the front. You got a Russian on your shoulder. And I was sitting on the edge of my seat. I'd already knew the result, but it was still pretty nerve-wracking kind of seeing you finish there. And he was close on you quick, but he just never got there.
Yeah, it's funny because I actually looked up the Russians' times on their IAAF profiles, because they had no times registered as in the para world just because of their ban. And it turned out they had a 147 and 148 800 PBs, but I couldn't find their 1500 PBs. So I had no idea how good they were going to be. And when the guy went out hard, I just sat on him. But the race wasn't very quick early. And Philo had told me before the race to only go to the finish line, like make the move only when you know you can get to the finish line without fading. And so I was thinking maybe 200 or 300, but I could feel the bunch catching back up. And I think that I heard the commentator say a group of eight. So I made the move at 400 to go. And I think 50 meters into the move, I just went, oh shit, I've gone too early here. And yeah, rounding the bend with 100 to go, I heard the commentator say, and the Russian's coming, which is an ominous thing to hear in any context, I suppose. But to hold on, because I think with 50 to go, I mentally thought I was going to get caught, but obviously I kept driving to the finish line. So I think that's why I had such a big reaction at the end, because I did not expect that entire lap. I've never been running with so much fear. I thought he was going to get me.
There's something special about that, isn't it, though? Seeing no one between you and the finish line. Like, it's there for the taking, and you kind of find a bit extra when you have to.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, like, I'm obviously run hundreds and thousands of laps around track, so I usually know when I'm going to come to the end of the straight. But when you're in that moment, that straight becomes so long, and I had no idea where it was until right before it, so I was just hoping it would come a little bit quicker.
Could you hear him, like his voice and stuff and footsteps?
Oh, yeah. He was a big boy, yeah. So I could definitely – I heard his footsteps. I heard his breathing, and it was definitely closing in. So, I was pretty nervous. And the funny thing was, his shadow kind of from the lights came straight over me, so I could see it right in front of me, right on the ground. So his shadow was literally looming over me in those last steps, which was pretty crazy.
So what does it mean? I think it was yesterday or the day before, like, Russia got banned from the Tokyo Olympics. What does that mean in the para world?
Yeah, so this is the thing, because obviously with the Olympics, each sport has its own governing body. So in 2016, the IOC decided to leave it up to each sport, and athletics opted with banning them. But in the para world, Russia was banned from the entire games without, you know, any discretion, really. So then they were allowed back in this year. But yeah, the news has come out in the last few days with WADA deciding to ban them. So I've only read a statement where the Paralympic Games have acknowledged the findings, but still no word on what they'll do with 2020. But I suppose if it's WADA, I don't see what they can do. So it'll be interesting.
Might not have to race him at Tokyo.
Yeah, which is funny. It's like, it's weird because, yeah, obviously it might make my job easier, but yeah, am I racing the best athletes in the world? I'm not sure. The Africans always are better at the Paralympic Games. They come from Kenya and Ethiopia for the Games, sometimes not always for the world champs. So it'll be high quality either way, but it's kind of a weird feeling because I talk to them after the race and stuff. So, it makes you realize they're just humans. But if their country is doing the wrong thing, then I suppose they've got to be banned.
Yeah, and then the 5K. How was it, about 5 or 6 days after?
Yeah, pretty much the next week, exactly.
And in the 5K, you had coach Phil O'Saunders and training partner, best mate, Tim Logan, kind of pacing you for this one. So tell us about something. Like, are you guys doing 400 or 800 meter reps or track work at that pace, like with them tied to you, guiding you? Like, how do you practice for that?
Yeah, we were doing a lot of stuff on the track, but we found it difficult because obviously they were doing the full session as well, so they were just as tired as me, and it's a lot harder when both of us are tired. So we decided to start doing guiding for pretty much all of our short, easy runs. So we racked up a couple of hundred Ks just with the tether. And we're running that closely together normally, but adding in the tether does make it a little bit more difficult or challenging. So yeah, we did that, and then we started doing drills, so high knees, B-skips, butt kicks, lunges, hopping, and just stayed in sync until it was kind of ingrained in us, because we wanted to get to the point where the tether, like even with the tether, I still felt like I was running as if I would, as freely as I would without, so that then the communication benefits would outweigh any disadvantage with the tether, which in the end we did. But there were so many races where we hadn't executed it, and honestly the first time we executed it to perfection was actually at the World Champs.
That's a good time to get it right.
Yeah.
So just on the tether, is there a regulation like length that has to be?
Yeah, it's a good business opportunity, because for this one guy in China, because now the Paralympics say that you can only get it off this guy. So they're 30 centimeters long, except 20 centimeters of that is taken up with the loops that you put your fingers in. So it's really only just over 10 centimeters between my hand and the guide's hand. So we are pretty much running as one person.
And does it loop around like your whole hand to be like around your wrist, tighten there?
It's only one or two fingers, depending on the preference there. So it's not very big at all.
Yeah, and then like it's just the logistics around, like, are you guys practicing when Tim's or Philo's arms, like left arm's down, your right arm's down as well? Like, you have to be in sync that way?
Yeah, so I focus on when I put my right foot down, they'll put their left foot down. So that, and then the arms will follow. So that's usually how I do it. The hardest thing is the changeover, because Tim has to come from behind and then get in sync with my footsteps, whilst also making sure that he takes the rope without Philo ever dropping it, because then we would get disqualified. So that's the hardest, because it's easy to pick up the rope, without getting in sync, but as soon as Tim gets the rope, we should really be in sync straight away, so as not to miss any moves or anything like that, which we actually did perfectly in the race. But in training, we made a few mistakes even 2 days before, so it was pretty clutch.
And then there's other people, like, obviously in the race as well. So, like, at what stage did Philo, like, finish up and Tim come into the race to swap over?
So it's we have to designate that before the race. So say Philo was to do a hammy or something with two laps to go, I would actually have to ride it out with him for those two laps. So we designated 2.4Ks into the race. And, yeah, we were still, you know, in the pack. So Philo had to navigate his way or my way through that pack to get onto the outside. But the thing with that, at the start of the race, he was so good because all I had to do was just look at the person in front of me, and he made sure that I was always in contact with the leaders, and I moved up when Philo thought I could move up. And you're not supposed to do any verbal coaching, so we had to come up with some, in terms of actually where you should be positioned. You can obviously describe stuff and whatnot, but we actually decided to come up with some kind of body language. So he'd pretty much just either yank the rope, or if I wanted to move out and go around, which happened with 300 to go, I'd just give the guide a big shove with my elbow. So it was pretty simple, but it was perfect because I just trusted wherever they thought I should be in the pack, I would go with them.
That's fascinating though, isn't it? It must take a lot of self-control for Philo not to be coaching, like, as your coach and being right there in the pack when you've got a massive chance to win a gold medal, and he's not allowed to say stuff and got to kind of keep his emotions under control as well.
Yeah, that's right. He's nervous as a coach and a guide. So, I just can't imagine the psychology in my guides, because it's totally different to mine. And I think the pressure on them is potentially even more, because they know that the decisions that they make on behalf of me could define the work that I've put in and the sacrifices I've made for 4 years. So there's a lot riding on them, but they do it so perfectly, and we know each other so well.
Well, that's the I wanted to bring that point up about, like, Tim Logan. Like, he's kind of sacrificed a lot of his season to be your guide in a way and go to Flagstaff. And, like, Tim's ran 14.01, I'm pretty sure, for 5K.
Yeah.
Like, this isn't a guy who's just, you know, doing it on the side and being your number one help out. He's actually an amazing runner himself, kind of thing. So, like, do you sit down and have that conversation with him and say, I want you to do this role and it's going to require this many weeks of, you know, focusing on someone else? I know he's getting fit, you know, going to Flagstaff and stuff like that as well. So there is some benefit for him, but at the end of the day, he's there to do this role for you.
Yeah, I think if I didn't have Tim and I didn't have Philo, it would be, the conversations I'd have to have with people would be quite a lot different and quite a lot more formal in terms of arrangements and whatnot. But I've known Tim since I was 13, and he's been, for most of that time, the only runner in my area that can keep up, and obviously Phil is my coach, so he's always going to be happy to do it. But, Tim and I we've just been training partners for so long. I nearly didn't even have to ask. It nearly just kind of happened because, you know, he's seen how hard I've been training and working for this since I can remember. So, but obviously there's sacrifices that he's making, and there's benefits that he's getting too now. Like, off the back of our win in Dubai, he's can be treated as a NAS athlete now. So he can get support from the VIS, because obviously, and this was true even before we were guiding in races, but if he's injured in training, it makes my training quite a lot harder, because I have to run either around really small loops or on the track only, because often when I adventure outside of those two places, it's because he's with me. So if he's injured, training becomes harder. So I need him pretty much the whole week. I need him to get the physio support, and I need him to get even the psychological support. So it's good that he's treated as an athlete now.
Yeah, I did like as well that Athletics Australia or whoever was in charge of, like, the publicity stuff over there, it was kind of like get to know this athlete, and they did one on Tim as well, which I thought was really cool, like, and treating him like it's part of the team and not just there for your thing, and then, get to share the glory a bit as well.
Yeah, and that's I think that's, like, why he's such a good mate and such a good guy, because he embraces the fact that, you know, that gold medal, it's not my gold medal, it's a team gold medal, it's a team sport. So I think, yeah, and I acknowledge that I can't do it without him. So, and I made sure that the Paralympic team and the Athletics Australia team, you know, they knew that I couldn't do it without him. So, you know, as soon as people realise that, they embrace him as a fully fledged member of the Paralympics team. And if he, you know, if we get to the Paralympics and do the 5,000 metres, Philo and Tim will become Paralympic athletes. So it's pretty special.
Yeah, and like that relationship, like running such an individual sport, but to have them there in the race with you and on the track and at the training camps, like, yeah, you're in a very special situation with Michael Roger as well, where it all feels like you can't get more team-orientated than what you guys have built there.
Yeah, I think that's the special thing about Philo's training squad, and even beyond the para part of the squad, just the whole squad in general, where Philo is so passionate about the sport, and obviously he's still running himself, and he's never asked for a cent from any of us. He just does it because he loves it, and he just takes on people that will fit into the squad, and where it's kind of like a little footy team, really. Like, we are so invested in each other's performances, and that's so special when we get to the games. And I know Rogues had his 1500 meters just after mine, and he you know, halted his warm up, and, you know, maybe even risked missing the call room to make sure that he stayed out to watch the race, and his voice was the first I heard after I crossed the line, and stuff like that's really special because, you know, he's my hero in the sport and I've grown up admiring him. So, yeah, it's just, I'm so lucky to be part of the group that I'm a part of.
Mm, for sure. And then, like, outside of running for you, like, people know that you've written a few articles for Runners Tribe. I know you're doing a few speaking engagements now. You got one with Toyota later on today, I think. Like, you've got the VIS scholarship kind of thing. So what's life look like outside of running, and how do you make it all work?
So obviously a lot of my income is coming from my running, but then my public speaking and my writing. So writing's a little bit of a hobby, kind of passion, but public speaking is probably on a more serious note, where I'm probably getting more chance to have an impact on people. So, you know, my talk today is on disability in the workplace, and as well as my road to Tokyo. So being able to do that is, you know, hugely important to me. But then again, I can't say yes to everything because training is so important, and my investment in performing well at Tokyo will then give me a better chance in the future to have an impact. So there's a lot to consider, and I organise most of it. I organise all of it by myself, just getting advice off Mum and off Paralympics Australia. So, yeah, there's a bit of admin to do, but I really enjoy it. And, yeah, if I can make a difference in even a small way, it's obviously worth it.
Yeah, cool. And then, like, we're started December. I think I may have seen your name down for Steigen hashtag one. Would that be correct?
Yeah, it's such a cool concept. I didn't want to miss out, although I'm not going to start racing, you know, the proper race distances until maybe late Jan, early Feb, as I've had a bit of a break from intensive training. It was my first time on the track last night, so yeah, whoever's drafting should probably know that, but I think I'll still be able to put up a decent fight in the race. But it's such a cool concept, and doing that stuff for athletics is really exciting.
Yeah, for sure. You'll be like, you'll easy get through the 3K and the mile. Like, I reckon you'll be in the last 15, 16.
Yeah, well, it's funny, like, this...
I'm going to draft you on our team.
Yeah, well, this concept would actually work. This would fit me perfectly if I was in the same shape as I was in Dubai, which I'm sure I'm not too far off, but
get a week's training under your belt, you'll be fine.
Yeah, well, that's it. So I don't know, maybe I'll still do really well. It's gonna be cool.
Yeah, what are your thoughts on like athletics and stuff at the moment, and kind of the Steigen kind of trying to be innovative, and like we had Matt Whitbread on the show last week talking about some of the changes they're making up in Sydney. And like, I think if I was ever putting a panel together of guys that I wanted to you know, get their ideas for innovation and make the sport more popular and driven with like media exposure. I reckon you'd be one of the guys I'd ask to be on the panel. So like, what are your kind of thoughts on it all at the moment?
Yeah, I think athletics has, or at least, you know, running especially, has so much potential. Running's got to be one of the most participated in sports, and yet a lot of the elites are relatively unknown to most of those people, which is, you know, that's something that surely we can change. And your podcast, that's doing quite a lot in that area, and that's something that we have to look at. And I think events like this, because if you look at the Tour de France and you look at why people follow football, and it's usually to do with a team, and people can, it goes beyond the individual. People can follow something, a symbol that is not just the person, and they, you know, I follow the Carlton Football Club, but I don't know any of the players personally, but I still feel invested because I'm invested in the symbol that is the club. So I don't know, I think there's something in that. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not quite sure on how, but
well, you see it in Japan, don't you, with their like Ekiden teams and how they run for a company all year round and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's somehow we need to go down that path and obviously keep all of the traditional distances, because the Olympics is still and will always be what the main part of our sport is. But I think on the side, something like a team format kind of season that isn't cheapened with, you know, weird events maybe. I think there's something there. I don't know quite how, but I think Steigen and stuff like, yeah, that the National Mile Championships, that stuff's really cool. So, yeah, just got to tap into that kind of innovation.
Yeah, and you're right about that team concept with like the AV Winter. Like, you look at how many people rock up to run Div 5 or Div 7 or Div 1 or whatever it is, like, you just run around a muddy kind of park with a whole lot of hundreds of people, but it's that you're representing more than yourself, and then people buy into that. I think you've nailed that a bit there, and I hadn't really thought about that too much in the past.
Yeah, my favorite races to run, like my most enjoyable races, are the cross country series races, because I love the area that I live in. I think it's awesome for running, and it's kind of like, if I'm representing the club, I'm also representing the area, so it's kind of like I feel like I'm representing something bigger than just my own ambitions. And I think it's, you know, that's what sparks the most passion.
Beautiful, mate. So we'll see you at Steigen, and then you, like, will you have to then back up to do like our nationals and stuff?
Yeah, so my races over the summer will probably not, there's no focus on running well, just training. But Victorian champs and national champs, I'll have a mini peak for, because I think the heats at nationals and the final at Vic champs will mimic reasonably closely what Tokyo might be like. So but otherwise, this season there's no real pressure to perform well, and you know, all our training will be focused towards peaking in early September.
Yep. And will you get to Falls Creek for some altitude work over the new year?
I've slowly transitioned away from Falls Creek just because the terrain is too difficult, but I really do like it up there. But we're going to go to Perisher.
Yeah,
Mount Kosciuszko, which is quite a lot better for me, just more dirt roads rather than single track kind of stuff. But yeah, definitely some altitude there. Then I'll do some heat training in Canberra, because my races in Tokyo are, for some reason, I've been put in the middle of the day, which is going to be pretty brutal. Just got to prepare for the heat too. So, yeah, it'll be a lot of trips between Melbourne and Canberra.
Yeah, and what is the turnaround with the 1500 and the 5K like? Similar to World Champs?
Oh, I have no idea who does the timetabling at these games, because there's only two. Well, I suppose there's three if you count the marathon events that my category can do, that's distance running. And they've put them all within like 5 days in a 14-day program of athletics, pretty much. So it's 5K first, 1 day off, 1500 heats, 1500 final, all in the middle of the day. So that's why I was so relieved after the 5K in Dubai, because if I hadn't have won, I would have decided not to do it. I would have just done the 15, but because of one now, I'll be able to have a crack at both. So I don't know why they do that with the timetabling. They could easily spread it out, but
yeah, that's going to be tough, isn't it? Like backing up for a 1500 meter heat with a 5K pretty much still in your legs.
Yeah, that's the risk, because obviously I would just want to win even one gold medal. So if it happens in the 5K, then the pressure's off. Doesn't matter how sore I am, I can just try my best. But if I absolutely empty myself and it's a silver, and that then hinders me for the 1500, and then I, because of that, you know, soreness, I don't win the 1500 either. It could backfire. So I've really, it's been a, well, when the program came out, I was pretty upset, because it just wasn't how I'd envisioned it. And yeah, I had to overcome that initial shock and realize that I just got to work with what I can. And it's apparently the games. It's not meant to be easy.
Yeah, for sure. And you guys have got a good team, good coach. You guys will be able to prepare for that and replicate in training and see how your body feels and make adjustments and go from there. Before I do let you go, though, you did just mention the M word, the marathon, and you didn't really sound too keen on it. Are we going to see you on the road sometime?
Oh, definitely. I think how soon depends on how 2020 goes on the track and the years after that. I have boxes with, you know, medals I want to win on the track before I go to the marathon, but it could be sooner than I think at the moment, or it could be later. With 2032 now, the bid's been put in by the Queensland government. I'll definitely be sticking around for those games if that ended up getting up. So there's plenty of years for me to do the marathon. And I think the marathon is the best event in the sport. So I think if I didn't go there, I'd be being a bit silly.
Yeah, and we see a lot of successful track guys go to the roads because of the money for the marathoning. And is that similar in like para sport as well? Like, there's more money on the roads than the track, or not so much? You stay on the track and get the funding.
Right now, I mean, the funding for medals is the same, but in terms of getting exposure on TV and stuff, traditionally the track's been better, because sometimes they don't have the cameras out on the course for the marathon. But now, you know, Rogues is capitalising on it. There's, you know, a race at London. He's been invited. I don't know if he's doing it yet or not, but he's been invited to a new para race at Boston. Then New York's looking at it, I'm sure, Berlin as well, potentially. So, by the time I get there could be a fully fledged para marathon circuit, which would be pretty awesome. So, I just love the thought of doing a marathon, but if there's money there, that'll definitely be an extra motivation.
Yeah, that sounds cool about the Boston stuff. I didn't know that, and then you'd expect them all to follow suit.
Yeah, well, that's what I was thinking. If Boston will do it, then I'm sure other places in America will do it. So it's exciting times.
Beautiful, mate. Well, thanks again for your time. Listeners, if you want to know more about Jared, as I said, Tell Me Your Tale, September 14, 2017. Any sponsors or anyone we need to thank before we finish off, mate?
Paralympics Australia, that whole community, my club at Diamond Valley, the support from running groups like Diamond Creek Runners and Crosby Crew, and I've been lucky this year to have Lauren Burns, Olympic Taekwondo champion, in my corner because of the Sport Australia Hall of Fame and Athletics Australia and all those kind of people in the Victorian Institute of Sport. So I really couldn't have done it without them, and obviously, yeah, my family and my training partners. So they're the people that make it happen.
In regards to speaking gigs as well, mate, if someone's out there listening and think you'd be a good fit for their staff or their business or their school or whatever it is, how do people go about that?
Yeah, my email address is jaredcliff@gmail.com, so JARYDCLIFF, or just contact me through Twitter and Instagram, and usually I'm pretty flexible with getting to most places, so if you think I'm worthy, then definitely hit me up.
Yeah, for sure. Awesome, mate. Well, thanks again for your time, giving it up for the Inside Rome podcast. We really appreciate it.
No, thank you very much, and thanks for what you guys are doing for the running community.
Mate, we just talk rubbish about running every week, and then we get to interview legends like you, so it's a good opportunity for us to talk to people.
No, thank you very much.